This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live on TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. Joining us on the program today, in about 30 minutes' time, we debut our brand new feature. It's called Saturday Spotlight. Richard sits down and talks to Jets play-by-play voice Paul Edmonds. You can hear that in about 30 minutes' time. Also on the program today, 1 o'clock, 1 hour from now, Brett Hedekin, San Jose Sharks radio analyst, is going to be on the show. Talk about the Sharks ahead of the Jets and the Sharks tonight. Game you can hear live on TSN 1290 starting at 9 p.m. And then at the start of the final hour of the show, Jim Fox, LA Kings color analyst on Fox Sports West, is going to join us to talk about the Kings ahead of the Jets game there in Los Angeles tomorrow. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. Without further ado, I say good morning, good afternoon, rather, to my colleagues, Richard Pollock, Ezra Ginsberg. Gentlemen, good to see you both.
Yeah, good to see you. How's it going?
Doing very well, Ezzy.
Awesome.
Yeah. Nice bright yellow shirt. You brought a pie into the studio for us today. That was very considerate.
Yeah, I had so much food.
Thanksgiving related.
I had so many people over for that first Jets game. I have so much food in my house. I need to just get rid of it. Like, I'm going to be 450 pounds if I keep all this food in my house. Like, I'm finding food underneath the cushion, so... Yeah. I just thought I'd bring it in, you know, maybe Timmy will have some, Remus, so whoever wants to eat it can eat it.
It's not a fresh pie, it's a box pie.
Oh, it was in the fridge.
No, no, it's not the pie you made.
I didn't make the pie.
No, it's a box pie.
We got off to a good start today when we were just getting a coffee right before we hopped on the air. Ezzy looked at the cover of a CD and said, oh, is that Sonny and Cher? To which I looked at the CD cover and said, no, that's Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett.
I mean, I can see how you could get the two of them confused.
I don't think I know what... I didn't before that know what Lady Gaga looked like.
She kind of looks like Cher. She doesn't look like Cher.
A little bit with the dark hair, the curly...
She looks more like Sunny.
All right.
I was a little off there, but...
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be the first time you were a little off. I think that's safe to say. Anyways, let's get started right away with the Winnipeg Jets. Their season opening victory on Thursday against the Phoenix Coyotes. A 6-2 triumph for the Jets over... The Arizona Coyotes, of course, now. Probably pretty much everything a Jets fan could hope for in a season-opening debut and a season-opening victory, aside from the injury to Evander Kane, which we'll talk about later on in the program. That was the Jets really being the better of the two teams and exerting their will against the Coyotes, large part and thanks to some horrendous goaltending from Mike Smith.
Mike Smith didn't play well, guys, but you can't take anything away from the Jets and this victory. It was very impressive, and sure, it's only the first game of the season, but the Jets controlled the play the whole game, and there were a lot of good performances, starting with Blake Wheeler. He had a great game. You know, the two goals in 15 seconds there in the first period, to me, the game was over after that. Jets ended up adding another goal from Mark Stewart, but the game's 4-1 after one period. The game's over, and we know the Arizona Coyotes guys don't score a lot of goals, but you can't obviously read too much into this victory because it's against a team that I think we'd all agree probably isn't a playoff team, or if they are a playoff team, they're probably not going to go very far in the playoffs. But I definitely think the Coyotes are a bottom five team in the Western Conference this year. But you look at the way that the top line played, and you know, Drew, you mentioned the injury. We're going to hopefully have some news as the show progresses here. Paul Maurice obviously said yesterday Kane's not going to play tonight or tomorrow, but you look at the way the Jets' second line played as well. And it was very impressive, and I was really impressed with the way Zach Bogosian played. He obviously got an assist on the Blake Wheeler goal with the point shot there. I thought he was very good. But again, you're playing a bad team. And again, Richie, we talked about this on the midweek show when we were previewing Thursday night's game. This is a game, especially when you look at the two teams that are coming up. This is a game that the Jets had to win.
You know, I caught a fair bit of the Islanders-Carolina game last night, the only game on the slate last night, and I found the games to be, you know, comparable in the sense that, you know, the Islanders looked pretty good last night. They played a very fast-paced game. You know, Carolina got into it at the end, but the point is they played a fast-paced game similar to how the Jets played. I like the speed at which the Jets played. They were playing fast. You know, they were creating and engaging in contact, and they were putting pressure on the Coyotes' defenses, as we pointed out on Wednesday, isn't really as good defensively as you might think. And I think Tyson Nash really acknowledged that when we spoke to him, Tyson Nash being the color commentator for the Phoenix Coyotes television broadcast. But also when watching the Islanders, and similar to when watching the Jets, I look at who they're playing. And the Islanders played Carolina yesterday, and the Jets played Arizona on Thursday. And the issue is you're able to dictate, both in road situations, able to dictate the pace and style of what you want to play because the other team isn't very talented. And I think that's a factor as well. And then you talk about some poor goaltending. You know, bad teams, if they don't have good goaltending, are obviously even worse. I mean, that's an obvious statement, but it's true. You know, the Wheeler shot on the first goal, I believe it was Wheeler, and then Mark Stewart's shot. I mean, these are goals that don't go in the AHL. And Dave Tippett called up Mike Smith after the game. But from a Jets perspective, obviously the Kane injury is disconcerting. We're going to hear more about that, we hope, some point today. And Jets fans are hoping for good news on that front. I think everybody's hoping for good news on that front. But they came out. They took care of business. As he said, it was a game, you know, it's not a must-win game, game one. But it's a game, considering who they're playing these next two games, that you want to get. And they got it. And I think they built confidence from it. You have to be encouraged by, you know, how fast they were playing. You know, Little, Wheeler, look at Dustin Byfuglien, I thought played a real nice game. The defense wasn't challenged a lot,
sure,
but played well with what they were challenged with. And, you know, Pavlik was solid. So at the end of the day, you got to be happy with the first game, but you can't read too much into it because it's one game. I always say this. If you think about this game as game 42 in the season, how would you analyze it?
Explain what you mean there.
By that I mean, if it's just any game in the regular schedule, you know,
as opposed to the season opening.
Exactly. How would you analyze it? You'd say Jets took care of business against a team they ought to have taken care of business against.
But let me interrupt you right there, because we have seen over the last number of years a number of instances when the Jets are the better of the two teams on paper, and they don't end up performing that way on the ice, or maybe they take a 4-1 lead after the first period, and they somehow and they let the other team back into the game. This was it was a 4-1 lead, and 95% of the game, no, more than 99% of the games in the NHL, when one team has a 4-1 lead, that game is more or less over. The Jets, to their credit, were able to strangle the Coyotes to make it a 5-1 lead, and rather than giving the Coyotes any life potentially, they took it right out of them, you know, from the second period on.
Yeah, they played. That's a good point, Drew. I mean, you know, this team would blow more games, especially under their former coach for whatever reason. And they played a more structured style this time. And the Coyotes really weren't able to create too much. Now, again, if you look at the Coyotes' best offensive weapon, who would the two of you say it is? That's a problem right there.
Well, it's probably,
you pause. You don't know, right? You have no idea. It's not one amongst three. It's one amongst three of the third liners.
Well, it's maybe Ekman-Larsson or Yandel.
Those are defensemen, though, Drew.
So yeah, I know. Bodker, Hanzel. They don't have enough talent.
Right. Maybe Shane Doan, maybe Sam Gagne. So, you know, disposable for Edmonton. Shane Doan's over 35, not as effective as a player as he once was. Martin Hanzel, with due respect, is a third line center on a really good team, you know, defending and playing defensively. And then Sam Gagne is a guy who you wonder if he's a tweener. So these are the issues that you can't also pressure based on that. But again, they've lost those teams before, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And they didn't just beat him. They beat him by a significant margin.
Yeah, and what's probably the most impressive and what you have to be most impressed with as far as that game goes, and again, the Arizona Coyotes aren't going to be a contender in the Pacific Division or the Western Conference, is the way the Jets really had the foot on the gas and didn't take the foot off the pedal. So they really crushed the Coyotes, and that is important, because when you talk about their schedule, and they've got the two games coming up in California, and then they have the five-game homestand, for a team like the Jets, they have to get off to a good start, and I think it'll help a lot in their confidence. And, you know, all after one game, everything's looking good, and, you know, it almost seemed like the Jets won the Stanley Cup walking around Winnipeg on Friday, but, you know, you get a victory, and you can't take that away from this group, because this group wants to get off to a good start and erase the memory of last year's terrible finish.
Your five-game homestand is Nashville, Calgary, Carolina, Tampa, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a pretty good homestand. You should be able to get three wins at least in that homestand.
Sure, looking ahead to that.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you look at the performance of the players on the ice. Blake Wheeler obviously was the best player on the ice. You know, two goals, an assist. Do you think, you know, his fight with Shane Doan there, do you think...
Wasn't much of a fight.
wasn't much of a fight, but it is something out of character, and for a guy who's
Tried to fight him.
Yeah.
Of course, Doan wanted to fire up his team as much as possible, but Blake Wheeler, it's definitely out of character, and it's the guy who, you know, he said throughout the preseason, or in the offseason, that that he's looking to take on a more of a leadership role. Is answering Shane Doan there, you know, sort of another sign of his leadership?
Does he have a choice, though? I wouldn't read too much into that just yet. If he engages, it's a little bit different.
Well, if you were watching that game as well, I mean, it wasn't a fight. I mean, Shane Doan takes Blake Wheeler, and he threw, like, what, two punches or whatever?
But he wanted to be
I mean, the idea there was for Doan, as you mentioned, Drew, to fire up his team. And Blake Wheeler took on a leadership role last year, and we talked about this a little bit towards the end of the year and during the season preview show a little bit. I mean, Blake Wheeler is the offensive leader of this team and in the dressing room. And I think if you look at in previous years, he's filling the void of other players that have obviously departed. But, you know, whether it's Olli Jokinen, who... And I mean, he was assistant captain for 2 years. How much of a leadership role did he have on this? How much of an influence did he have on this room? I don't know. A guy like Blake Wheeler, he's been with this franchise now for a long time. And I think, you know, it's pretty funny, too, that Blake Wheeler was actually drafted by the Coyotes and kind of by the one Jet that's 1.0 that's still in the league. So it's kind of a bit of a nostalgic thing there with Doan versus Wheeler. But Blake Wheeler is clearly has already taken a leadership role on with his team. And he's... You know, like, let's be honest, guys. He was the best player in the game, and he really, you could really tell that, like, this guy, he doesn't take nights off, and that's another issue with this team in previous years has been.
Well, and let's see how they play against some top defensive pairings coming up these next two games. Let's see.
Brian Little, talk about him. I mean, 2 goals. Is it possible that, you know, a lot of talk this year about Scheifele and Perreault coming in, and Brian Little sort of flew under the radar, as he's done for a lot of his career, you know, and for whatever reason, I think he's, I mean, he's probably not, he's not a number one center, but is he a better number two center than people give him credit for?
Yeah, myself included, I think he's played really well. And, you know, I think a successful season for him is proving that he's a top, you know, top half, top 10, kind of second line center in the National Hockey League. Certainly played well in game one, too. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how they, you know, share ice time with these lines and you know, wanting Perreault on the power play and wanting to make sure the Scheifele line gets out there if Kane's healthy. So, Kane, obviously, that injury might shuffle things around with Byfuglien, I believe, moving up. So, but no, you have to be encouraged, Drew, by the way he played and, you know, really well. And he played really well last year. So, there's nothing really to complain about on that, and I think he's really kind of fulfilled the potential that he has. I don't think the team expects another step, like another significant step, but if he doesn't, I think they're happy with what they got, especially at the contract number, and that was a good contract by Shevoldayoff, for sure.
And I think, guys, the idea, and Maurice has said this, really, it's 1A and 1B lines. I think the idea this year, whether you call it the second line or the first line, because we know that Evander Kane, when he's healthy, Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler, that they want to get that line going. Those are the three most talented players on the team. That's their top line. But the idea with giving them less minutes is for this line, with Michael Frolik and Andrew Ladd, obviously, is to give them more of a defensive role and start to match them up in different situations, as opposed to sending that line out and expecting these guys to be your biggest offensive unit. Now they have that they have those lesser minutes, and now they're going to be playing against other teams' second lines and top lines. So that's the idea there, I think. And especially with Michael Frolik there, who's an excellent two-way player, that's the idea there. It's time for Evander Kane and Mark Scheifele to really take a lot of the offensive burden for this team.
And, of course, we'll talk about the Evander Kane injury a little bit later on in the program. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll look forward to tonight, the Jets and the Sharks, 9 o'clock here on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Past the top of the hour. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and this segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey, conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. We looked back in the first segment on the Jets victory on Thursday night against the Phoenix Coyotes, Arizona Coyotes. We're going to look forward to tonight's game right now against the San Jose Sharks, 9 p.m. here on TSN 1290. The Jets actually have had some success against the San Jose Sharks.
Yep.
Last year, two wins, one loss, even winning in San Jose at the HP Pavilion, which isn't that called the SAP Center?
Yes.
And they change the names all the
time. Yeah, they change the names all the time. I can't even keep track. You know, the Sharks are pretty similar team.
It's like when we were at the border, Drew, and somebody called you Andrew. Nobody knew that was your full name.
That was really random of you bringing that up.
Different names all the time.
Yeah, but you guys knew my name was Andrew.
Fortunately.
Your name's Andrew?
Yeah. Anyways, the Sharks are a very similar team to what we saw last year during the regular season. Of course, they had that epic collapse against the Los Angeles Kings, you know, where they had the 3-0 lead in the first round of the playoffs and lost in seven. You know, the big subtraction is Dan Boyle and Brad Stewart on the back end. Of course, they move Brett Burns from forward back to defense to try and fill that hole. Up front, I mean, their big addition really isn't much. It's sort of Ty McGinn is their most notable addition to that.
From the Flyers.
Yeah, from the Flyers to that team. You know, what can you expect from the San Jose Sharks against the Jets tonight? The Sharks, of course, winning their season opener, spoiling the Stanley Cup banner ceremony of the Los Angeles Kings earlier this week.
Yeah, it's the Sharks' home opener tonight, and we all saw how they dismantled the Los Angeles Kings. I was watching that game, by the way. I don't know if you guys were thinking this, but I thought it was a little bit of a bad luck for Dustin Brown to be hoisting the cup. I thought that was a little bit ridiculous, but that's how they celebrate in L.A. But no, the San Jose Sharks, you mentioned some of their changes. I mean, this team has gotten a lot younger, and a lot of the focus, guys, has been on the captaincy and how Joe Thornton obviously is now an A and he doesn't have the C. And then earlier this week as well, we were talking about Logan Couture and how he didn't get an A and he was disappointed and all that. And I think, to be honest with you, that's a lot of it's made out to be more than it is, really. I think we know who the leadership group for this team is, and it doesn't matter if you put 1A, 5As, whatever. Thornton and Marleau are still the leaders of this team, and until Thornton and Marleau aren't on this team, those will be the leaders. So you're talking about Mirko Mueller, who looks fantastic, and they were calling him, you know, Mark Edward Vlasic 2.0, but it's the younger players, and you've got Chris Tierney and Thomas Hertl and Matthew Nieto. Like, you can see that how they are preparing for life after Thornton and Marleau, guys. And, you know, you get rid of Marty Havlat and Boyle, and these were players that really only have a few years left in the NHL. No disrespect to them. I mean, these are older players. So this is a very talented team. They can score a lot of goals, and as we saw in that LA game, they can score goals in a different a variety of ways. Tommy Wingle's a player who's a third-line guy, but he's a very talented player. They roll out four lines. I still think, Richie, this team is excellent defensively. You might have some question marks in goal. Is Antti Niemi good enough to take them anywhere? But this is still a very good team, a top team in the West for sure, in my mind.
Yeah, talent-wise, for sure. A little top-heavy on forward. When they put the wingers, you know, they're putting Marleau and Pavelski on wings, when in reality they're both centers. But that speaks to how deep they are.
It's a good problem to have.
Well, exactly. The reason the Jets play against the Sharks well is because the Sharks are a big team, like the Jets are, pretty big, and they can skate like the Jets can, but they're not that physical. The Jets aren't that physical either. So the Jets seem to match up quite well. You know, the Jets play against the Kings team that's big but physical, and they have trouble. They have trouble penetrating the offensive zone. They have trouble on the cycle. They have trouble defending the cycle. The Sharks are playing a very up-and-down game, fast, you know, a speed game. The Jets can skate with them. So, yeah, do I have concerns about, say, you know, the party, a party post-ma combination and a bad matchup on the road? Yeah, I do. For sure, speed-wise, that can be a concern. But the Jets match up pretty well against the Sharks team because it's going to be a skating game tonight. The Sharks still have a ton of skill. I mean, you look at their defense pairings, and then, you know, as he brought up Mirko Mueller, and he's a rookie obviously playing beside Brent Burns. Brent Burns is a talent, but I think his talent is best utilized on defense. I think that's a good decision. He's got a huge shot. He can move the puck out of his own zone. He can join the rush if he has to. And I think we may still see him a forward depending on any moves they make down the road, and we'll ask we'll ask Brett Hedekin about that later on in the show. But you look at that combo, and then you look at the other combos that they have, Mark Edward Vlasic and Justin Braun. Justin Braun's a very solid two-way defender. And then Jason Demare and Scott Hanano, you have your solid defensive defenseman with Jason Demare, who's an offensive guy.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Talk about Mark Edward Vlasic, probably perennially underrated, an Olympian. What makes him so good on the back end for the Sharks?
Well, you know, Drew, is he underrated anymore? I think it's a fair question to ask. what makes him so good, very good skater, very smart, Lidstrom-esque in the way he gets into positions, has a long stick because he's a tall guy, makes it difficult to get around him because he can skate, very positionally sound, nice first pass. Never turned into the offensive defenseman, maybe they thought he would, but the way he's turned out into defensive defenseman, I think they're very happy with the way Mark Edward Vlasic has become a top two guy, really. Justin Braun doesn't get a lot of attention, very solid player. You know, their third pairing isn't the best, but Jason DeMeyer can certainly create a lot of offense, and Scott Hannon's seen better days, but he's made a longer career than maybe some had thought, including myself. So the Sharks are, it's going to be a tough matchup for the Jets in terms of what they faced on Thursday versus what they're facing today.
Well, you're going
speed,
from
size, and skill.
Lower-end talent to yes. upper echelon talent.
You're not going, from Arizona, to, maybe even a Vancouver to San Jose. You're going boom, boom. So it's going to be interesting to see how they adjust.
From the penthouse to the outhouse, or the outhouse to the penthouse.
And it's going to be interesting from the Jets. Sorry to interrupt you. It's going to be interesting from the Jets' perspective. And how does San Jose play against them? San Jose played against a team that knocked them out in Game 7, knocked them out up 3-0 against L.A., defending champs in L.A., motivated. I mean, the Jets aren't exactly a team that makes another team motivated. They don't really have any rivalries, so maybe they take him lightly.
Submission a little bit. Let's talk about the Jets forward groups for this game, because obviously we know Evander Kane's not going to play.
Nope.
So what had initially the Jets had hoped to be their top line, Kane, Scheifele, Wheeler, is already getting shuffled around, and it sounds like it's going to be Byfuglien, Scheifele, and Wheeler, and then Ladd, Little, and Frolik is going to, we expect that's going to maintain the same, although of course Frolik did not skate yesterday. They called it a maintenance day. We'll find out probably through the course of the show if he skates in the game day skate today.
Mm-hmm.
So, any concerns about already shuffling of the lines for the Jets? How do you think Byfuglien, Wheeler, and Scheifele will fare against the Sharks?
Well, I think they have to obviously shuffle the lines. Evander Kane's health status is unknown right now. We're going to probably find something out today, hopefully, while we're on air, but we might not. It's indefinite, and Paul Maurice wouldn't say that Kane is out day-to-day, but yeah, so they're going to move up Buff. Buff can play left wing or right wing. He's played the left side before, but I actually like that decision, Richie. You keep Ladd, Little, and Frolik together. They're probably going to go up against the Thornton line.
And Halischuk on the other
one. Then Halischuk comes in. Gagliardi probably move up to the third line.
I guess Halischuk's going to move to the third line, I think.
Or maybe
Halischuk is supposed to be playing with Perreault and Lowry.
Okay.
And the fourth line, the new GST line, will supposedly remain the same.
Right.
Gagliardi, Slater, and Thorburn. That's based on yesterday's practice. We'll see what happens with the game day skate
and
today.
And obviously, you lose Evander Kane. You're losing one of your best offensive players, so that's obviously going to hurt the Jets. But as we know, guys, you have to deal with injuries throughout the year. And if that means that you have to move Buff up, there's going to be more pressure on him to get going. And he's played with these players before. We saw him a little bit last year. So the concern to me is not so much the moves that they have to make for tonight's game. It's what is the status of Evander Kane's health, guys? If Evander Kane's out for 3, 4, 5 weeks, I mean, you're going to have to wonder who's going to fill that spot on the top line, because then you're probably going to have to move Andrew Ladd up there or somebody. I don't think Byfuglien is a permanent solution there. I don't think you want him playing on the first line.
I don't mind even playing on the first line. The problem is Byfuglien is more of a natural right winger than a left winger. And so, granted, he scored a goal going down the left side on the 2-on-1 there in the first game, but and he made a nice tip. You see how awkward the tip was. It was a very skilled tip because he's a skilled player. Does he set up on the left side? And, he's a right-handed shooting guy. Doesn't mean he can't play the left side, but that's more of a rare thing that you'll see. Frolik on the other side is a lefty, plays the right side. That's clearly the best position for him. He's comfortable on the right side. So the only other option you're looking at would be bringing clearly a bottom liner up to the top. You don't want to do that. You want to keep your most skilled guys together, in my opinion. And then you look at the alternative of maybe Wheeler, only because Wheeler seems to flourish when coming down the left side, especially at 4-on-4 and power play, but sometimes at even strength as well. Maybe they kind of flip-flop them a bit, and if so long as they're okay with their defensive responsibilities, I'm okay with that as well. So I think that's what I would do as well. I have no issue with the way they're structured the lines for tonight's game if, obviously Kane's not going to play, and depending on Frolik.
What's the Jets' secret to success against the Sharks forwards? Flipping it around that way, look at the Jets' defense against the Sharks forwards.
Yeah, that's a tough question, Drew, because they're going to come at you with a lot of speed and size, and I have concerns if I'm a Jets fan with how the Jets fare on the left side of their defense against this team. And so by that I mean, how does Enstrom, who's giving up a lot of size, Stewart, who gives up some speed, and Party, who certainly gives up speed, how do they fare against the transition game of the Sharks? Okay? So you're looking at the right side really there. Right? And so you're looking at a guy like Pavelski or whether it be Nieto, whatever it may be, Tommy Wingles. How do you adjust to quick plays, quick passes against those guys getting caught in transition? And if you get turned around a bit, who's making up for it? So that would be my biggest concern is you know, the Sharks kind of making quick plays out of their own zone and pushing the pace against the other side of the defense. And also wearing down that side of the defense on the forecheck too. Because if you see, you know, smaller defensemen or slower guys, you're going to put in that corner. So that would be one of my concerns for tonight.
Yeah, and I don't think the thing with the San Jose Sharks, and, you know, they really don't get enough credit in my opinion. You hear a lot about the LA Kings depth and all that, but let's not forget this team was up 3-0 on the LA Kings. Mm-hmm. So sure, they blew it, but this team... It's not as simple as obviously Bogo and Enstrom are going to see a lot of the Joe Thornton and Pavelski line. They're going to see a healthy dose of that. But then you bring out the second line, you've got Logan Couture. So, I mean, they've got three solid scoring lines. We're going to talk to Brett Hedekin a little bit later. I want to ask him about Tommy Wingles because he's a very underrated player, really good third line guy. And it's not as easy as shutting this team down it's not just about shutting one line down.
That's right.
And you look at the San Jose Sharks, guys, year after year, and the good teams, this is a hallmark of all the good teams, the San Jose Sharks are a very good 5-on-5 team. They're not a team that particularly kills you on the power play. It's a team that scores in units, and, you know, so the Jets are going to need a very good team defense performance if they want to win tonight in San Jose.
The Jets and the Sharks, 9 p.m. here on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. When we come back, the debut of our new Saturday Spotlight feature, Richard Pollock and Paul Edmonds one-on-one.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Shortly past 12:30 in the afternoon here on Saturday, The Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN1290, and we're pleased to debut our new feature airing every Saturday on the show.
The Illegal Curve, Saturday Spotlight.
The Saturday Spotlight for this week features our own Richard Pollock sitting down with the voice of the Winnipeg Jets here on TSN 1290. Paul Edmonds.
The Illegal Curve.
The interview will last about 30 minutes or so, but we'll take a break halfway through. Here is Richard Pollock and Paul Edmonds in this week's Saturday Spotlight.
Paul, I want to start off going way back to 1996, April 1996, when the Winnipeg Jets left Winnipeg on their way to Phoenix. What were your thoughts at that time? Like, growing up as a hockey fan in Winnipeg, what was going through your head when the Jets left town?
Well, I think a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings, for sure. I think that I always, like a lot of Winnipeggers or Manitobans, held out hope that there was going to be some sort of a last-minute deal to keep the team here. But when we look back on the history of it, we shouldn't be surprised that they actually did leave, because the team had started to have problems going back to the early 90s, and, you know, it was just basically a stay of execution. And there was different ownership groups that were trying to build arenas, and they were trying to funnel money from infrastructure projects to build arenas through the government, and there was public-private shares. It was all sort of many different parts that were moving all at the same time. And then, of course, you get to that last season, which was 95-96, which I remember going to a number of games at the start of the year, and it was quite sad. I mean, I remember Ottawa came in here, and there was like 8,000 people in the building during that last season with the Jets. And then it got really interesting, because people realized that this was the last opportunity that they were going to see the NHL and the beloved Winnipeg Jets 1.0. And by Christmas, the building started to fill up, and then you couldn't get a ticket for the last 10 home games. And, you know, that was great to see, but it was a little too little, a little too late. And one of my most vivid recollections of that whole season and the way things unfolded was about four home or three home games remaining. Philadelphia came to town with Eric Lindros, and I got tickets to go see the game. The Jets won the game 4-2. Lindros and Tkachuk actually got in a scrap fairly early in the game. It was a dandy, and the place was pretty raucous, and I left with a pretty good memory of all of my Jets days that go back to the WHA as a kid, getting tickets as a patrol through elementary school. So I left with a fond memory there, but definitely, Richie, a lot of heartache like everybody else, and I definitely, for sure, had a hangover with the NHL for a few years after that. It was very emotionally draining, and I think that that lasted for a number of years in our community.
Did you ever think that they would come back, Paul?
I thought that based on, yeah, I did. I didn't know when, but I thought there was always an opportunity, and I think the first thing that needed to be done was a new building. And, you know, True North and the Chipman family were able to get that done. And then you had to have an owner that that was deep-pocketed, and obviously, you know, Mark has been able to go out and find a partner to be able to do that and make the team financially viable. I also think that we had to have an attitude change here. And in some ways, whether it was latent, subconscious or not, I think that we, as a community, step back and say, okay, why did we lose this team? What happened here? And in a lot of respects, it was, well, the team never got supported. People didn't want to put their money down to really go and watch the NHL. Perhaps we looked at our diminishing population, which is growing again for our city now, and we needed to get bigger as a city. So there was all sorts of different elements that had to come into play. But yeah, I didn't lose hope that we would never get the team back, because I know there was a lot of prognosticators that had that attitude, and I was never one of them. I just didn't know what the time frame would be, and as it turned out, it took 15 years.
You said you were growing up, you know, you grew up on the WHA and, of course, then the NHL. What are your radio memories, Paul, of the Jets during those times? Obviously, now you're going to be the play-by-play guy for the Winnipeg Jets, and be young kids like you were listening to you. What were your memories radio-wise?
Well, my memories go back to Ken Nicholson, and that was in the WHA days. And, you know, he was real good. I didn't realize how good he was at the time because I was a kid, but I remember, and I've told this story before, but I think it begs mentioning again, almost maybe ad nauseum, Richie, but I got a transistor radio as a kid. I can't remember if it was for Christmas or birthday or whatever, but I remember tuning into Jets games while I was supposed to be sleeping and listening to the games. I mean, that was that important to me. I was playing the game as a kid, organized hockey. I loved it. Had dreams like everybody else, but I really liked the aspect of the broadcast medium. And I had an uncle in the business. He was in the newspaper business, but I was able to kind of follow him around a little bit and kind of got starstruck with the ability to cover sports as a job. And I thought, you know, this is something that if it doesn't work out in my playing career that I would like to pursue. So from an early age, I had a pretty good idea of really what I wanted to do. And then, of course, it was how do you get there. From there, you know, I got into high school and then into college, and I was a big fan of the Winnipeg Jets in the NHL as a late teenager, early 20-year-old with Kurt Kiel back on the radio. You have to remember, even at that time, we're talking late 80s, early 90s, that the games just weren't available on TV like they are now. Mm-hmm. So radio was the medium to follow the team, and there was no Twitter, there was no internet. So if you had any interest in following what the team was doing, especially on the road, the radio was your only sort of companion or your only source to be able to bring you that that game. So, you know, I went from Ken Nicholson to Kurt Kielbach, and I think as I got older, for sure, the Kurt Kielbach experience with me listening to him really fostered more beliefs that this is what I wanted to do.
And you're a homegrown Paddock, of course. You know, Paul, you attended Red River College Creative Communications Program. How did that program, you know, prepare you for the career that you embarked on?
Well, it certainly gave you a news judgment. It certainly stressed the ability to write, and I think that one thing that sort of the mantra was, even going back then, I don't know whether it still exists, but I would think so, they always said, if you write well, you speak well. So there was a real emphasis on writing, and I really kind of took the ball and ran with it from that standpoint, and really tried to become a better writer, with grammar and spelling and mm-hmm. all the elements that go into being a decent writer. But at the same time, I think what it did was it expanded your vocabulary so that you were able to introduce yourself to new words and then use them verbally, which I think really helps as a broadcaster as well, so that you're not stumbling around and fumbling for the right word to describe something, especially in radio, where it is the theater of the mind, and you have to be descriptive. And sometimes, instead of using a phrase, you can use one word to get that point across to the listener. So the Creative Communications program was excellent for me. It taught me a lot. The broadcast end of things, I had some decent radio teachers. I had a good journalism instructor. So it gave me a new sense, a journalism sense. It certainly gave me structure on what was right, what was wrong. And then the other part of it is they encouraged you to really go out and get the practical. And whether that was pro bono, which a lot of it was, mm-hmm. To build up that resume fodder, you were encouraged to do that. And I certainly did that. I did a lot of freebies and loved every minute of it, because I knew that at some point somebody was going to pay me to do this. And ultimately they have.
I'm joined by Paul Edmonds for the first edition of Saturday Spotlight. Paul, of course, the new play-by-play voice for the Winnipeg Jets on TSN 1290. Paul, what was your first job in radio?
It would have been, I think the first full-time job would have been with the Regina Pats. It was interesting because at that time, in the late 80s, going to the early 90s and then into the mid-90s, radio stations had gotten away from retaining play-by-play guys as also their sports directors, and it really kind of happened throughout the West in junior A hockey and then into major junior as well. And I was one of those guys that went from being in the journalism field and particularly print and doing some radio as a color guy in Swift Current on a part-time basis to a full-time play-by-play job with the Regina Pats in the Western Hockey League. But I wasn't employed by the station. I was actually employed by the Regina Pats. Mm. So we had an affiliation and a relationship and a partnership with the radio station. But the radio station, at that time, a lot of them didn't want to incur the cost of having a full-time employee to do play-by-play and then be a sports director. So what they wanted to do was provide the time, they wanted the content, but they didn't want the salary. So the teams took those on, and I was one of those guys. So for a lot of years, I used to joke with buddies that I sold out a long time ago when it came to journalistic integrity, because I was actually working for the team in broadcasting. But that would have been the first one that was full-time, was with the Regina Pats, and we were on a couple of different stations the couple of years that I was there. But that was a great experience for me and really kind of kick-started my play-by-play career for sure, not only in hockey but definitely in baseball, because I actually, in between the years that I did the Regina Pats, they would cut me loose for the summer. There was no requirement to have a media guy and a play-by-play guy full-time. So I actually used a hockey demo tape to get my first baseball job in 94 in Lethbridge, which was kind of odd. But, as they say, the rest is history.
And if my research is correct, you had an important meeting at the restaurant Pomodori's.
Yeah, Pomodori's.
Pomodori's, sorry.
Yeah, no, it was, it's no longer there. I think the Safeway's there now, but it was in Madison Square, and I got the job in 94 in Lethbridge in the Pioneer Baseball League, and my parents had tipped me off that Les Lazarek, who was doing the Gold Eyes games with Peter Young that first year that the team came back and won the championship, was moving on to do the Saskatoon Blades in the Western Hockey League. So there was an opportunity for sort of a second radio guy in baseball. So I reached out to Peter Young, and the next thing you know, I was in for Christmas from Regina. And I sat down with Peter Young and Sam Cates at Pomodori's, and we had a meeting. And next thing you know, I was offered the job, and we talked talk money, of course, and I wasn't really in that big of a position to grind anybody, so I accepted what they offered. And 19 years later, I resigned from the Gold Eyes after what I would have to categorize as a pretty decent career on the air with the local professional baseball team.
That's an understatement, Paul. When you took the job with the Gold Eyes, how long did you think you'd be there for?
Well, through the 90s, I thought at that time, Richie, there was still some AAA teams that existed in Canada, Edmonton and Calgary. And I actually had an opportunity to go to Calgary and do the AAA games, and I thought, okay, this was sort of the advancement that I was looking for. Because the AAAs, you know, or the AHL, you're one step away, right? Even in our careers or our chosen fields. And it turned out that the station that was negotiating the rights for the Calgary Cannons didn't get the play-by-play rights, so therefore they didn't require me, so I stayed on here. And I think early on I was looking to advance, and wherever that meant I had to go. The one thing I quickly discovered, though, at least in baseball, was I was born on the wrong side of the border, and it was real tough for anybody to try to convince U.S. immigration that you were better at calling baseball than some American guys. So I knew that my advancement was fairly limited until you got to the major league level, and it would have to really exist in Canada. And then as teams started to float out on the AAA level of Edmonton and Vancouver and Calgary and Ottawa, you're kind of looking around going, boy, I'm in a pretty good spot here, and I'm in my hometown.
Right.
So I think I got to somewhere around 2000 and realized that this is where I was going to make my home, and this is what I was going to do, and this is the team I was going to do it with for the foreseeable future.
You know, you call obviously hockey and baseball for a long time, Paul. I heard Matt Devlin, the voice of the Toronto Raptors, recently say in an interview that the best way to learn how to be a broadcaster, in his opinion, was to call baseball. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've never really thought of that, but it was definitely a challenge. I'll tell you a story. My hockey career was really first and foremost, and then, as I mentioned, sort of serendipitously, or the need for more money over the course of a summer, I got into this baseball thing. Now, notwithstanding, I always loved the game of baseball too, and I was in Lethbridge, and I was on the first broadcast that I was doing, and the sports director walked in at one point and into the press box and walked right over to where my equipment was. And, you know, you always have a crowd mic, right? And there was a little knob to adjust the crowd mic, and he came over and he turned the crowd mic way up. And I realized that there was quite a bit of dead air in between pitches because I wasn't filling properly, and he at least wanted something going across the line and through the radio. So that really made me realize that you have to be able to fill, weave some stories or some conversation, which essentially you're talking to yourself, in between balls and strikes. So, yeah, it certainly made me a better broadcaster from the standpoint that you had to be relaxed, you had to be poised, you had to be prepared, you had to just kind of throw the fear of saying something wrong or the fear of failure or anything right out the window and just talk. And it's kind of like the game of hockey in a lot of respects. You hear coaches say, you know, if you're out there thinking, you're not reacting. You just need to react. And I've always reminded myself, or I did for a long time, that if I got on the air and I was constantly thinking about what I wanted to say, it wasn't going to work that way. You had to develop a flow, and you just had to go with it. So that was another thing, too, is the flow of the game. It took a little while, but you develop that after doing more and more games. And then, of course, as the seasons go along, you've built that that experience in the back of your brain to recall certain plays or players or scenarios, and all of that goes into kind of producing a better broadcast as well, because you have that experience to draw back on from not even a book or a binder, but from your own recollection in terms of your memory. So, yeah, baseball, I think, really helped make me a better broadcaster for sure. How could it not when you do that many games? And if you didn't do them very well, I'm sure that they would have found somebody else. But when I look back at that first game in Lethbridge with the sports director walking in and turning up the crowd mic to where I got to last September in my last baseball game with the Goldeyes, I'd come a long way.
You're listening to Richard Pollock's interview with Winnipeg Jets broadcaster Paul Edmonds. When we come back, part two of that interview during the Illegal Curve Hockey Show's Saturday Spotlight.
You're listening listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're in the midst of our debut of our Saturday Spotlight feature. Richard Pollock one-on-one with Winnipeg Jets play-by-play broadcaster Paul Edmonds. You just heard part one. Here is part two of that interview.
Did you have a broadcasting idol growing up, Paul?
Broadcast idol? It probably would have been either the two guys, the aforementioned gentlemen that I talked about in Ken Nicholson or in Kurt Kielbach, definitely, because they were local guys here, and we followed the team that way, and they were hockey, and I wanted to get into that. I always admired Bob Costas for his ability to not only broadcast baseball, but have talk shows or host national TV events. I've always thought a lot of Bob Costas, and certainly as I got a little bit older and we had the ability to watch more games, whether it was through center ice or extra innings packages through our cable providers, or in my case, Bell Satellite at home here. If I had an opportunity the last several years to come home and watch West Coast baseball, it was going to be Vin Scully and the Dodgers. And I'm not even really a Dodger fan. I just really admired the longevity that he's had in his career and the ability that he's had to really tell stories and paint pictures and do it just such with a relaxing voice and a tone that just kind of draws you in and makes you feel real good. So in terms of idols, there was nobody that I had a poster on my wall in my bedroom of, for sure, but there was definitely guys that I listened to that I thought were really good, and I listened intently to see how they were good, how they presented themselves and the game, and certainly what made them to be the icons that I thought that they were. There was even guys like in the Western Hockey League when I was younger, kind of growing up, that I would listen to. Kelly Moore would be one of them. Mm-hmm. I remember when Kelly was in Kamloops, and I thought Kelly was really good. There was a guy in Lethbridge named Steve Falwell that I thought was really good. Rob Carney and Moose Jaw I thought was an excellent play-by-play guy in hockey. So there was guys across the league that when I was younger and kind of filling my boots in this thing as a Cub broadcaster that I was listening to a lot to see how they did things and how I could get better by, in some cases, mimicking them or just kind of stealing some tricks of the trade.
I'm joined by Paul Edmonds on the Saturday Spotlight. Paul is, of course, the new voice of the Winnipeg Jets on TSN 1290. Paul, you mentioned the hockey calls, play-by-play experience you had in the past, and most recently you've also been calling Selkirk Steeler hockey games. I want to ask, calling hockey games, calling baseball games, your vast experience in baseball, thousands of games that you've called, what's the biggest difference between calling a hockey game and calling a baseball game?
Well, definitely pace, for sure. I mean, the game's way quicker, that being hockey over baseball. But I think that the two games, you have to know players, so that's number one. You have to do your homework on records, tendencies, stats, those kinds of things. So there are similarities that way in terms of your preparation. But the games are completely different in the speed that they're played at. And so, to be able to go from baseball where it's a little bit more relaxed and you pull back a little bit and you don't have to be talking all the time, and you can take a couple of seconds in between pitches to, as we say in the business, or I was taught, to let the game breathe a little bit. Mm-hmm. Hockey, certainly on radio, which I think differs from TV for sure, you have to be on top of everything. And the one thing that I think that you always want to keep in mind with hockey play-by-play is, and you get asked this or get told this or by listeners, where is the puck? With baseball, you kind of have an idea of where the ball is because it's always going back to the mound before the play starts again. And then when the ball gets put in play, you're going to mention where the ball is. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen as often as hockey. Hockey, it's constant up and down. It's north-south. And you have to let the listener know where the puck is. So that's the element, I think, that's really the difference is where the play is and where the object that you're trying to score with is located on the ice. So pace of the game and certainly some of the other nuances would definitely say that the games are different when you're calling them, but in a lot of respects, the preparation and certainly the ability to get prepared to do the games is much the same.
And you talk about, you know, learning how to let the game breathe, and I think it's interesting now because you're going to be in the booth and you're going to have a color guy with you, which you've had before, Paul, but how much of an adjustment is that for you in terms of calling a, you know, 3-hour game on your own and then now calling a 3-hour game, as you mentioned, a different pace and also having somebody else in the booth?
Yeah, baseball's been interesting that way because I've always done it alone. And with hockey, I've always had a color guy for the most part, at least the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. I had Brandon Rewicki with the Selkirk Steelers and in the past and some other jobs. I've always had a color guy. I really enjoy working with a color guy on the hockey broadcasts. I think that it adds an element to it for sure. Sometimes I think when you see guys that work alone, it's necessitated by cost, right? Especially right. at the minor league level or at major junior hockey or junior A. You work alone because they just don't have the budgets to pay two guys. So that's how you kind of end up having the ability to bring a broadcast as one voice and be as full as you possibly can. But no, I have really enjoyed working with color guys in hockey for sure. And, you know, I had a couple games with Shane Knighty last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a seasoned pro after 3 seasons of switching careers from player to broadcaster. And I've worked with Brian the last 3 years as well as his color guy. And we're going to work together this year. So I really enjoy having the other set of eyes for sure, and then certainly another opinion right beside you that you can feed on, and get what they're seeing out there too. I don't think it really hurts. You know, we're always talking about the numbers in hockey and analytics and the eye test and what's better or is it a combination. But I always think that certainly when you're looking at the game and you're broadcasting it as quick as it is, if you can have that extra set of eyes mm-hmm. and the eye test on what's going on and how teams are playing, whether it's in the offensive zone, the neutral zone, or the defensive zone, can certainly help and give the listener a better idea of what's happening on the ice.
I read that you called 112 games. You'd call 112 Goldeyes games in 130 days and be riding the bus all the time. So is you know, 82 games over 7 months a piece of cake?
Yeah. I guess the other thing is you're traveling in the winter, right?
Uh-huh.
As opposed to traveling in the summer. And I think anybody that lives here would know that I think you'd rather be traveling in the winter than in the summer. So that's a difference for sure. You know, I think that any time that you involve yourself in a schedule as long as 82 games or as it was a couple of years ago with the Goldeyes, 112, you know, there comes times where, as exciting as your job is and how much you love it, I mean, you still have to kind of get yourself up and march yourself out the door, right? So is it a grind? No. But mentally, it is a bit of a marathon, so you have to prepare for that. And I don't really know that there would be much of a difference. I think that with hockey, you'll get a few more evenings off than you would in baseball because you play every day, and that would be ultimately the difference when you look at it. But still, there's going to be requirements to travel and time away from home. So there's a lot of similarities that way, too. It's just that you're playing a few less games. Now, you know, if the Jets get into playoffs, Richie, you know, maybe there is the potential for somewhere of about 100 games, but maybe that might be a couple years down the road.
It may be, and you know, you talk about traveling, and of course, you know, a lot of the bus trips that you're taking with the Goldeyes. Does that, you know, and putting in time and a lot of time, a lot of those bus trips, does that make you appreciate more, you know, going to be able to travel the way you're going to be traveling with the Jets?
Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about it. Everybody, when the announcement came down that I was going to take over the role on the radio and do 60 of the 82 games, a lot of the feedback that I got from people was, you know, you've paid your dues. And I never really looked at it like that. Every time I was either driving or on the bus or whatever it was, whether it was in mm-hmm. Major Junior Hockey, Junior A, or with the Goldeyes, okay, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm ticking off another one of these days here on the bus going to OCN or down to Laredo, Texas, as I'm paying my dues. I mean, it was my job and I enjoyed doing it, but at the end of the day, I think whenever you've been at the minor pro level for as many years as I had been, to get this opportunity, you look and say, boy, this is really something else that I don't think that it will ever be lost on me, the move up from minor pro to the major leagues in terms of the amenities that you are given. And travel certainly is one of them, at least with the Jets, because it's all airline and it's charter. So, yeah, I definitely have an appreciation for that. And it's kind of funny. I'll tell you a story. The first year that I was asked to do some color was the first year the Jets came back. And I got to know one of the flight attendants on the Jets charter, and I was on a road trip, and at the end of the road trip, the team was flying home, I believe from Nashville, and he came up to me, and he kind of bent down in the aisle, and I was on the aisle seat, and he said, have you enjoyed the last week or so? And I said, yeah, why? Can you tell? He said, you've had a smile on your face for the last week and a half. And it looks like you've enjoyed yourself. And I think that kind of tells exactly what I'm trying to say and to answer your question that, you know, I was just real, not just happy to be there, but certainly appreciative of the opportunity that was given even when I was just filling in a couple of years ago. And now it's become a full-time occupation for me. So, yeah, there's definitely appreciation. You've heard that throughout sports, too, is the guys that have been the journeyman minor pros that finally get there and never really lose touch or the recollection of where they came from, and I really believe that that's important.
That certainly makes you likable amongst other qualities, Paul. I want to ask you, you know, you talk about time away from home and working a lot of nights and the travel associated with it. How important is family and all of that, and, you know, being able to not only support you but, you know, pick up for when you're not there and other opportunities that you're not able to, you know, you're not able to see in life experiences because of the travel associated with your job?
Well, I think, and I'll be real honest and frank here, if you didn't have somebody at home that was supportive, as my wife Tanis is, this would be a non-starter. If you're coming home and, you know, you're getting it in your ear about time away or travel or days consecutively that you're not home to help out, it would be more of a burden than I guess sometimes it is because you are away. But everybody's adjusted here. I mean, let's face it, my kids until this summer didn't know Dad to be home. Because I had been doing baseball for 19 years and my oldest guy's 12. So everybody just was adjusted to when Dad would go away and when Dad would be home. And this is just sort of the way it is. And we're just going to, I guess, kind of extrapolate that this year, except it'll be just in the winter as opposed to the summer. So I think it starts at home. You have to have the support of your family, which I do. And that really stems from the foundation of the home. And in my opinion, that's my wife here. And she's very supportive. And I have really, through this summer, Richie, understood how busy she has been the last several years with the three kids and running off to baseball and soccer, because I lived it this summer. And I thought to myself, oh boy, how did she do this alone for all these years? You know what I mean?
That's amazing.
But she did, and I think that through all of that, I've gained a larger appreciation for her and what she had to do when I was not here and absent because of time commitments on the road with the baseball club that, as I said, will extend now to this winter with the Jets.
Final question for you, Paul, and appreciate you joining us on the first edition of Saturday Spotlight. What was your reaction when you were told that you'd be the new Jets play-by-play voice on TSN 1290?
Kind of surreal. You know, okay, is this really happening? Have I really achieved the heights that I wanted to get to that for so long I didn't know if it was going to happen? Again, I got to about 40 years old, which was coming up 8 years ago, and I made the decision that I wasn't really going to chase the dream anymore, and I was going to be very satisfied continuing my career with the Gold Eyes and Junior A hockey and maybe filling in with the Jets here and there on the broadcasts on TSN 1290. And I was, you know, to use sort of a street word, I was pretty cool with that, you know. But then this comes along, and it's like, oh, okay, and what are you going to say? Even at 47 or 48 years old, no. You know, so very surreal, and I just kind of really looking forward to getting started in it and grabbing a little bit of ownership on it, if you can understand that, and just getting a few games out of the way and really getting into it and understanding the players, the personalities, and just feeling comfortable. Because I think that's important, too. And once you get that comfort level, I think that the broadcast will be much better as well, because you're not worried about extraneous things and how you're doing or if it's okay. So, yeah, it was quite a moment. Took a little bit of time to kind of sink in, but certainly something that I'm just ecstatic about having the opportunity to do, and very excited and very grateful for the opportunity from the station and certainly the administrative people that have given me the chance.
Well, it's very well deserved, Paul, and we appreciate you very much joining us today on the first edition of the Saturday Spotlight.
Richard, thanks very much. Anytime, and you guys on IC, keep up the great work.
I appreciate that, Paul. Thanks.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Winnipeg Jets play-by-play voice Paul Edmonds for being the debut guest on Saturday Spotlight. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes and on illegalcurve.com. Next week on Saturday Spotlight, Richie's going to sit down with former goaltender, current broadcaster, Marty Biron, talk about his career. When we come back after these messages, we're going to be joined by San Jose Sharks radio analyst Brett Hedekin. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at TSN1290.ca. Drew Mindell alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. We were going to be joined by Brett Hedekin this segment. He's actually going to, we're going to push him back about 15 minutes as San Jose Sharks head coach Todd McClellan is going to be speaking to the media. So we'll talk to Brett Hedekin about the Sharks in about 15 minutes time. This segment is brought to you by Linden Market Dental Center and Dr. Les Rikus. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center, 204-487-2226, or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Gentlemen, we all saw in the game on Thursday against the Coyotes, Evander Kane's injury left the game early in the first period after colliding knee-on-knee with Mark Scheifele. We know he will not play this weekend in either of the two games. Based on how the injury looked, it's hard to believe that it's only a short-term injury. We don't know yet, so I'm not going to speculate. Let's talk about the impact of that injury on the Jets, both on a short-term basis and on a long-term basis. Because, as we know, there's always a lot of chatter around Evander Kane and whether or not he wants to be in Winnipeg, you know, for an extended period of time, whether or not he wants to see his contract finish here with the Winnipeg Jets before he'll become an unrestricted free agent. If the news is as bad as possible for Evander Kane, and if he's out for months rather than weeks, what does that do to his relationship with the Winnipeg Jets going forward this season and beyond, in your mind?
No, I don't think it really does anything, Drew. I don't think the interest, short-term, long-term here are mutually exclusive. And by that, I mean the Jets obviously need Kane to play well to have a chance of making the playoffs. And probably Kane wants to play well because he wants to play well, but also if he does want out of town, the best way to get him out of town is to have him perform at a high level, making him more appealing to other teams. So, you know, I think that this hurts the Jets because it would hurt their playoff chances. Does it hurt their chance to trade him? I don't think it'll actually, you know, it hurts their chance to trade him if they're going to trade him. It would hurt it by the fact that he can't perform at a level that maybe makes him more marketable. I don't think the injury will have any long-term effects on his tradability, if that's a word.
Yeah, and it's terrible timing for Evander Kane. We know that last year was a rough year for Evander Kane, and he missed 20 or so games last year with a very few injuries. And you look at what he's trying to prove himself this year. I know, you know, every time we talk about Evander Kane, there seems to be, you know, the elephant in the room seems to be the possibility that he's moved. Well, as far as we're concerned right now, he's part of this team in the, for the long term. He's under contract long term. So, four more years, but that's long term for Evander Kane, right? So, I mean, you look at the injury, and for him, he has a lot to prove because, as we talked about in the first segment of the show, Now Evander Kane is going to be asked to play more. We've already seen in the last couple of years, Evander Kane is playing more on the penalty kill. And now he's the top line left winger with Scheifele and Wheeler. So for him, it's unfortunate. And I know, you know, there are speculation, there's rumors that, you know, he might get moved or this or that. Well, he's a member of this team for now. So it's terrible for him. And how do they cope with filling that offense? Well, it's going to have to come by committee. So tonight, you'll see Dustin Byfuglien on the top line. But I don't think, again, we talked about this in the first segment. I don't think he's a solution on the first line. I think they'd rather have him play wing on the third line.
Hang on, Ezzy. Why don't you think Dustin Byfuglien? I mean, given the options that the team has, and if Evander Kane's out long term, and you know they could always, I suppose, trade to try and acquire somebody that can help fill that void.
They're not going to trade. Who would they have to trade?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That would not be in fitting with the persona of the team thus far. Mm-hmm. Why isn't Dustin Byfuglien really the only answer to fill that role?
Well, I think he's the only answer. Like, I would disagree. I think he is the only answer, and I know he might be playing out of position, but you need to have six guys who can play, and skill-wise. And what's the alternative? That's the problem I ask. Like, you can't put a guy like Hašek into the top six. Perreault, you can't really play out of position, or can you? Then you're really going to hurt your third line. Lowry doesn't have the offensive skill, at least not now, to be able to take that jump. And so I'd rather play Byfuglien out of position. Or maybe, Ezzy, what you're saying is Byfuglien plays with Ladd and Little, and Frolik, while not slated to play the left side, does because he's a left-handed shooting guy.
To me, if Evander Kane, and again, we'll hopefully find out while we're on air here, but we might not find out till closer to the game, but if Evander Kane is out for any significant amount of time, I would rather see either Andrew Ladd move up to the top line, even though he has great chemistry with Brian Little, or Frolik, to me. And Dustin Byfuglien's never been a first-line player for a significant amount of time on forward at any point in his career, and I don't think he can play those minutes, and I don't think he, on the left side, playing with Scheifele and Wheeler, that would be a good fit long term. I think it's one thing, you know, tonight against the San Jose Sharks, yeah, for Buff to go up to the first line, but I think he's really more suited, and I like that Perreault, Byfuglien, Lowry line. I think they complement each other. They can score and do a lot of good things. They're a good physical line. Lowry likes to crash and bang. They, you know, Perreault is obviously the skilled player on that line. But so they're going to have Maurice is going to have some decisions to make if Kane is out long term. You're going to have to see, you know, some of these pieces moved around, because, you know, if you're putting Byfuglien up at first line and he's playing more minutes, is he going to be able to still play the power play? Because as we know, Byfuglien's not a guy that plays 30 minutes a game. You know, usually about 20 minutes a game now. So.
Well, it's also what minutes you're playing. Right. Power play minutes aren't as hard on your body as even strength minutes. Defense minutes aren't as hard on your body skating-wise as forward minutes are. So what are the minutes going to be?
Right.
In terms of how are they going to be allotted?
Going back to Evander Kane and the word you invented, his tradeability. Yeah. I mean, the Jets were sort of, the thinking was, and I mean, we asked this on the over-under on Wednesday's show about how many games he would play for the Jets this season. You thought it was going to be over because the Jets would almost showcase him for the year and then try and finally consummate a trade potentially in the offseason. If there's nothing to showcase this year, how does the team then go ahead and consummate that trade in the offseason potentially?
Considering his age, the contract, the potential, I don't think it would adversely affect. I don't think it would take it. I think him playing might increase it, but I don't think him playing will decrease his value. So that's how I feel. So if he doesn't play at all, I don't think it goes down, but I think if he plays, it could go up.
If anything, it has to be a concern for the Jets as far as Evander Kane's development goes, because he,
yes,
even though he played all 48 games during the lockout year, he missed 19 games last year, and the injuries have been not significant enough to keep him out for a long period of time, but he has missed quite a bit of time, and he's not getting into the flow. And he's an important, if not one of the most important, the most important player for this team, maybe with the exception of Andrei Pavlik and other players. Because as we've talked about, this core group, we've really got what we've expected out of the core group with the exception of Evander Kane. He still hasn't become that 35-goal, 75-point guy, 40 goals. I still think he has the potential to do that. And all this does, Drew, is this just interrupts that development for him, and it's really unfortunate. And you hope, and we're hopefully going to find out today, that it's not a long-term injury.
Well, that's what the Winnipeg Jets fans are waiting on pins and needles to hear.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be slightly concerned. When Paul Maurice says it's not a day-to-day thing, I mean, is that then a week-to-week thing?
Right. Or week to week. I mean, I think if it's week to week, I think the fans would probably breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. I think their fear is that it might be a long-term, month-to-month thing based on... I mean, Evander Kane is a tough guy. You know, he's always proven that he's been a tough player and that he's going to play, you know, through most injury. And the way he immediately clutched that knee, we've all seen, you know, we've all watched sports, be it hockey or football or anything else. you know, when you go down to your knee and you come out and you give it a test for 20 seconds and you can't go, that tells you that there's something, you know, wrong with that.
Yeah, and he's in great shape. Best skater on the team. You know, power skater on the team, meaning like he just comes at that puck so hard in the corners. So, yeah, I mean, Drew, it's not a matter of this is a fluke injury here, right? I don't think it's a, I mean, are you concerned he's become injury prone? That's so hard to judge. You need a little more time probably to determine that. But it's a tough one just the way it happened, too. You know, if you were to ask Mike Keane, who works for the Jets now, Mike Keane and Pat LaFontaine years ago, you know, skating in the middle of the ice, Mike Keane doesn't see Pat LaFontaine, it's on the Rangers, and that's the last concussion for Pat LaFontaine, who had concussion problems, and that was the last we saw of him. And it was a similar play in terms of just not seeing each other in the middle of the ice. Shifley said, I put my head down for two, you know, two strides, looked up, and boom. Now, it's not as significant of an injury as the one to LaFontaine, but the idea is, you know, these are just fluke injuries. They randomly happen.
Exactly right. Let's head to break. Brett Hedekin's ready for us, so we're going to give him a call. When we come back, Brett Hedekin, San Jose Sharks radio analyst, joins us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.